Before we can find the right solutions to our present distress and pain, we must properly define the problem. As painful as it might be to confront, we must acknowledge that the dominoes that knocked over the entire political establishment in 2016 were in place and beginning to tip over decades ago. The grievances and frustrations that allowed Donald Trump to take power have been gathering force since elites in both parties pushed through policies that helped to wreck America's middle class. Now, we are all paying the price. In this chapter, we look backward to better understand where we need to go and what we need to do now. My awakening to the discontent and divisions in America began when I started law school at Yale University. Yale gave me my first peek behind the curtain to see real power and privilege and how it operates in this country. When I arrived on campus, I had never been out of the United States. Before seeing the Atlantic Ocean on my trip north, the biggest body of water I had ever seen was the Mississippi River. Suddenly, I had to navigate a universe in which my classmates were world travelers who had been attending the world's top educational institutions since they were little kids. Many were legacy admits, meaning that their parents or grandparents had graduated from Yale. They felt completely at home among those Gothic buildings and other high-born children. A few students on the broader campus came from legendary families whose surnames were fixtures in American life. I came from a small town in the rural South. The son of two public school teachers, I had attended public schools myself with no prior exposure to the upper crust of American society. My only claim to fame came through my maternal grandfather. When I was young, the Ebony magazine list of the top 100 most powerful African Americans always included my mother's father, Dr. Chester Arthur Kirkendall, the president of Lane College in Jackson, Tennessee, from 1950 to 1970. He was also, by the time I was in junior high school, the senior bishop of the Christian Methodist Episcopal Church, CME. In my teen years, he was our small denomination's equivalent of the Pope. It came as a small surprise when I realized that none of my Yale classmates had ever heard of Lane College, the CME Church, or my granddad. The biggest shock for me was the way in which wealth and racial differences separated Yale students from urban youth who lived in the neighborhoods surrounding the campus. Being a super nerd, I had stayed out of trouble in high school and college. To this day, I have never tried drugs or alcohol, so I was stunned to find that some students at Yale did use illegal drugs. There was even a place on campus called Mental Hygiene, which seemed to function as a detox or rehab center. But when New Haven's urban youth, some of whom lived in housing projects just a short walk from the campus, did the same drugs, they didn't get to go to a rehab center. They went to prison. And when they came out, they were labeled drug felons for life. How could young people in the same age group, breaking the same laws in the same town, be treated so very differently? This struck me as the opposite of the ideal of equal protection under the law, which I was reading about in the law library every night. My disillusionment with the system was already growing. Then came April 29th, 1992. That night, Los Angeles exploded in blood and flames in reaction to the refusal of an all-white jury to convict four white Los Angeles Police Department officers who had been videotaped savagely beating an unarmed black motorist named Rodney King. The stunning verdict sparked protests and disturbances in dozens of U.S. cities. President George H.W. Bush sent troops into L.A. to impose order. I watched the L.A. rioting on television from where I sat in San Francisco, shedding tears born of rage and sorrow. Though we were hundreds of miles north of the violence, San Francisco's mayor, Frank Jordan, declared martial law. The jury's decision and subsequent uprisings were the defining events of my young adulthood. When I first saw the video, I felt that I could have been Rodney King. I winced at every blow that landed on his prostrate body. Had the jury convicted the officers, I would have celebrated thinking that America was finally confronting the unspeakable horrors of police brutality that Dr. King denounced in his I Have a Dream speech. Instead, the U.S. court system seemed to be giving a green light to every police officer in America. In my mind, the verdict read, "It's open season. Do whatever you want to do to black men. Film it for all we care."